Hi, folks. Just a little note before we start the actual show. Some weird shit went down last week. You might have noticed we had a guest on our show, Reed Mahalko, who literally like a day after the show came out, a news story dropped on the Daily Beast saying that he had been sexually coercive toward porn star Kelly Shibari. And it was kind of a bomb dropping in our community. As it should have been, because this is an educator who teaches about consent and how to flirt with people and negotiate sex stuff without making them feel coerced. So,
and that's something we talked about a lot last week, too.
Yeah.
So it was kind of intense to see that come out.
Yep, it was super, super disheartening. And it's just always really, really hard when people who are so publicly feminist and consent-focused violate those standards in these ways. I mean, it's difficult when anyone does it, but, like, I feel so distrustful of, like, people and the world when stuff like this happens, and it was really upsetting. We made the decision, after thinking about it a lot, to leave the episode up because we ultimately felt that y'all deserved the transparency and the context that would be provided if we left that episode up. We did add a little warning / disclaimer to the beginning of it, though, because we wanted to make sure that y'all knew what the deal was, and, like, if you didn't want to listen to that episode, which would be totally fair, we wanted you to have that option available to you. And, yeah, I think we just wanted to acknowledge off the top that, like, it sucks that that happened. And Reed released a statement today at time of recording, which was, I think, a fairly full-hearted, unreserved apology to Kelly Shibari, where he really, like, owned up to all the stuff he did, and he laid out a plan for, like, what he plans to do going forward, which I think is how you do an apology for this kind of thing. Like, it's, you know, it's obviously super shitty to have done it in the first place, but I think if you're going to apologize for something like this, you got to own up to it, and you got to say what you're going to do differently and how you're going to fix it. And I think he did a pretty good job at that, but we'll see. You know, it's hard to know whether someone will actually ever follow through and stuff like that. So, yeah, I'll be interested to see what happens. Thanks for sticking with us. I know it's been a really tough and triggering week for a lot of folks in this community, and I'm really sorry if it's been a hard week for you, and we're sending you our love and support. And this week we're going to do a listener questions episode, so stick with us. That is coming up after the break. Welcome to the Dildorks, dorky discourse on sex, dating, and masturbating. My name is Kate Sloan. I'm a sex journalist, a sex blogger, and I really like when people think I'm smart and important enough to ask me for advice on shit. Makes me feel like a real goddamn adult, you know? Sometimes you just need a little dose of that feeling. Who are you, friend?
I'm Bex. I'm a sex educator and a sex blogger, and I literally live for when people ask me for advice on things, because I'm a Virgo, and I assume everyone needs me to tell them how to do everything anyway, so it's just when you invite that from me, oh, such joy.
Can I ask you for advice off the top before we get into our listener questions? I have a quandary. You actually know this whole backstory, but I'll tell the audience for context's sake. So, I had this crush on a barista for like a couple months, like a year ago, a while ago. It's been a minute. And then I was no longer working in the area where his coffee shop was, and I went back a couple times to try to like ask him out, but he wasn't working any of the time. So I kind of like resigned myself to like, oh, I should have asked this dude out while I had the chance, and now I've lost my chance. Whatever, it's fine. We seemed to hit it off. We had chemistry, whatever. So then, like, almost a year later, I get a message from dude on FetLife, and he's recognized me, and he remembers me. He remembers where I worked. He remembers details about our conversation. So I was like, oh, interesting. Positive signals. Maybe he's into me. and we talk about kinks a little bit, and he's getting a little bit too sexual for me for the first few messages. Like, I prefer people to be a little more respectful and, like, take it slow on that stuff, because I'm a sex writer. I'm used to people crawling into my DMs with their weirdly explicit messages to a stranger. But anyway, so he has an interest in hysteria kink, as in the kink of reenacting those, like, Victorian scenarios where doctors would, like, give women orgasms for, like, medical benefit, which is the thing that I feel a lot of ways about. So I decided to shoot my shot, as the kids are saying, and I was like, hey, like, if you ever want to, like, discuss hysteria kink over drinks sometime, I would love to do that, which is probably the best way I've ever asked someone out. Like, that is a grade A date invitation. Yeah. So then he comes back at me with, like, well, I'm in a long-term relationship, so I'm not accepting new patients at this time. However, here's a bunch of very explicit questions about your vaginal fluids, etc. And I was like, you didn't say a monogamous relationship, but I feel like it was implied by what you said. And why are you asking a stranger all these dirty questions if you're in a monogamous relationship, my dude? Like, is your partner cool with this? So I haven't answered him because at this point, I'm kind of like, this dude seems like a slime ball. I don't think I want to engage with him further. How do I respectfully resolve this situation, or do I just ghost?
Yeah, I have a lot of complicated feelings about this. Because I have just a lot of feelings about this.
Yes.
Because I've been along for this whole saga.
I know.
And so, first of all, I was very firmly in the camp of, because at first he was also kind of boring.
You think so? Right? I mean, he asked me about hysteria kink. Weird? That's not boring.
No, but wasn't he being weird before that? Like,
I mean,
conversationally? Oh no, he just had bad grammar in the first message.
Yeah, you were not into his spelling and grammar, which, fair, that is a thing that is important to me in my communique.
Yeah. And I think his, just like, his syntax was weird. Like, they weren't sentences. That's what
gotta
it was.
Have
something about him.
Syntactual.
Something about him. Yeah, I was like, you can't go on a date with this dude, except because of the history, you have to go on a date with this dude.
I have to. That's why I asked
you
him.
You have to.
I was
right.
Like, I can't not at this point. Star-crossed lovers, really.
Right. But now he's being weird.
Yeah.
And, like, if you want to salvage any chance at, like, a thing, you can ask him about, like, monogamy stuff. Be like, oh, like, is it cool for you to be having these kinds of conversations, whatever, but, like, also, you just don't have to answer because he's being weird.
Yeah, I
he's
feel
doing
bad
that
not
weird
answering.
So here's the thing, if he was a stranger, you would not answer this message in your DMs.
Oh, it's true.
Like, you would have answered the hysteria kink one, maybe.
Yeah.
And then once he started asking about your junk, because your blog name is Girly Juice,
mm-hmm,
you would have been like, here are my rates. So, like,
you
just
said
because
that with the
he's
exact
made you
level of that's always how I say it in my head. I'm like, here are my rates.
But, like, just because he's made you coffee does not mean he gets to ask how much cum you make. Like, that's not they ask your name at Starbucks, but that's not a thing they put on the cup, so he doesn't need to know.
Oh God, what if they wrote Girly Juice on my coffee cup, and then everybody would think that I call coffee Girly Juice, which is just an absurd, why would anyone, no thank you.
I think, yeah, like, I think this is a case of, like, him seeing you, and, like, I don't know, like, being into you, but then being like, oh, this is a sex person, and just pouring all the sex stuff at you, like everyone always does when you're sex people.
Just dousing me in my own girly juice, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, and that is not entitled to a response. You can also just say, you know, hey, listen, like, I'm not super into chats like this with someone who, I'm inferring from your last message that you're monogamous, in which case this conversation feels kind of icky to me.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if you get to a point where it's within your boundaries or you're interested in getting a coffee sometime or whatever, hit me up again.
Yeah.
And then you can kind of keep that on the table. But,
yeah,
like, honestly, I don't think much will come from it except maybe a cool hysteria scene. I don't see you spending any length of time with this dude.
Right. At this point, I'm kind of like, I think it would probably be better for me to just find somebody who I do connect with in a kink way and romantically and be like, hey, I have this hysteria kink. Would you want to try this thing?
Yeah, I think like, that probably makes more sense.
Part of me was excited about him because I was like, oh, I've never met anyone else who's interested in this kink. Like, we should, like, play with it together because he was flirty. But now I'm like, you know what? Like, there's
and
so many kinksters
cool,
in this
super cool story.
Yes, yeah. It was like, definitely that, like, magical thinking thing where I was like, oh, but we have history, so therefore we have to date, which is actually not how it works.
Nah.
Nope.
I have history with a lot of people I'm never going to date.
Like me. That would be weird.
Yeah.
Sometimes I think about that, like, what if one day we just rom-com
it? We were basically dating, just, like...
That's true.
Not fucking.
All my partners consider you a metamor, so, like...
Yeah.
Same diff, yeah. Okay, let's get to the listener questions. I'm excited about these. This is one we got a little while ago. I think it's interesting. There's a content note on this one for an adult grooming a minor and subsequent psychological bullshit, also masturbation. Thank you for this listener for including their content notes. That is wonderful. I'm going to read what they wrote to us. I first learned to masturbate in any remotely enjoyable way when I was 15, and an adult friend I had online took it upon himself to teach me. Things escalated and we did stuff on cam. He introduced me to some kink things, like calling him master, without giving me an adequate explanation of DS stuff or any form of aftercare. That sucks, I'm sorry. And being 15, I thought we were truly in love. Turns out he wasn't, at least, and now I'm 20. My problem is that since that was my main formative experience with masturbation, I now barely masturbate unless ordered to by a domly partner. Oh, I know this life. It's partly because jerking it and being entirely alone with my thoughts is scary, but largely I don't believe my orgasms are worth anything if they aren't titillating someone else. I just can't find the motivation to get off just for me. I have a high sex drive and love orgasms during partnered shenanigans, but I was wondering if you had any tips for building my relationship with my own body and sexuality into one that's fulfilling without a partner or partners involved. Ooh, this is a big, meaty question. I'm into it.
This is super interesting to me. So this is the first time I saw this question. I didn't see this one beforehand. But the first thing that comes to mind is that that was very much my mentality around masturbation when I was 20.
Mm-hmm.
And for a little while following that, I didn't start masturbating until I was... I discovered it when I was like 17 because a partner was like, you should try doing that one day. A partner at the time who really enjoyed it herself and was like, maybe consider it. And even then, I very rarely did it. It wasn't until, and I was very much, for me, I was never drawn to it without a partner because sex and kink is very, very psychological for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wasn't bodily motivated. Try testosterone, though. That shit'll get you motivated. Because now I'm like, hey!
Not real advice. But, let's clarify that.
I know they need real advice. and this is a serious question, and, like, I am taking it seriously.
Yeah.
Testosterone is a fucking trip, though. No, but in reality, I also wasn't orgasming, so I was reading all of these books that were like, if you want to learn to orgasm, do it yourself. And I was like, fuck you. I don't wanna. I know better than this book because I'm 18. And like, I legit, first of all, you don't have to masturbate. Yeah. I assume because you're writing to us, you want to. Mm-hmm. But you by no means have to. You can simply enjoy sex as a partnered thing, like, that can be your experience of it, and that was my experience of it for a while. And then when I started reviewing sex toys, I had to jerk off semi-regularly, and I found the ways that helped me enjoy it. So it could just be a matter of, like, playing with it more and more solo and getting a grasp on your own body. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes, I also have a hard time sometimes now where I get too much in my head because of gender stuff, which not obviously not the same thing as dealing with like a trauma or anything like that, but it is very much keeping me in my head and out of like feeling what feels good. Mm-hmm. So I can either, I'm really big on like really elaborate fantasies of my own. So like closing my eyes and building a story. Mm-hmm. But also porn or audio erotica is great, or even music. I use that if I'm getting too looped up in my head or around an anxiety spiral, even when I'm not masturbating. I have certain albums that I'm able to fall into, and like experiencing the music is enough to occupy the part of my brain that would normally be worrying.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of overtaxing my brain so it doesn't have extra room to freak the fuck out. So something like that might also be useful if you can grab something to grasp just a little bit of your attention, just enough so that your mind can't wander because it's busy already, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I was reminded when I read this question of this article I wrote for my blog a few years ago called How to Repopulate Your Sexual Fantasies, which I'll link in the show notes at thedildorks.com. And I wrote it because at the time I had been through, I can't remember if it was a breakup or a rejection or something, but basically I was thinking about this person who had hurt me and I was having trouble masturbating without thinking about them. But then whenever I would think about them, I would get really sad. So, you know, that makes masturbation difficult, obviously. So I investigated all these different ways to kind of repopulate my fantasy life, which was like porn, erotica, fantasizing about celebrities I had crushes on doing kink things I was curious about, seeking out erotic fan fiction. Like if you go on Archive of Our Own, you can like use the filters to find only explicit stories, which is fantastic. I've like discovered so many new kinks through like Sherlock and Brooklyn Nine-Nine fanfic. And those are great because they get you out of your head, so you're not thinking about like people from your past. Like you're thinking about people who you can very vividly picture, who are not like intertwined with your own psychological history. The other thing that came to mind for me when I read this was my friend Caitlin K. Roberts, who is a somatic sex educator, talks a lot about the idea of a time-limited container for sexual experiments, which I find really interesting. Like, you can use this for, like, partner stuff. Like, you can be like, I just want to try this thing for, like, 10 minutes. Let's see how it goes. And it's very low pressure. Like, whatever thing you want to try, it really makes it easier because you know exactly what the container is. And I think that that could be useful for masturbation, too. Like, you could be like, I'm going to touch myself in this particular way for 10 minutes. I'm going to commit to that. If I don't want to keep going after 10 minutes, I can stop. And that's totally fine. But if I do want to continue, then I can continue. And I think that that's a really good way back into it. You can do that with anything. You can say, I'm going to use this vibrator for 10 minutes. You can say, I'm going to read this dirty fanfiction story for 10 minutes. And if it doesn't turn me on by the end of it, I will go close that tab and go do something else. And I think that that's just a way to enforce a little bit of structure on yourself to try to get yourself into masturbating in a way that might make it a little more palatable to you.
I also think looking at masturbation as more like an exploration or experiment instead of like, okay, I'm going to go make myself have an orgasm now. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah.
You talk about how it seems like you're trying to get to a point where you're jerking off for your own pleasure exclusively, but you could also, as like a stepping stone, frame it as, okay, I'm going to experiment to learn more about my orgasmic responses, to learn more about my body and how it responds to touch, and to learn all of these things so that I can bring that information to a dominant.
Mm-hmm.
So that can kind of conceptualize it in a way that, okay, it is somewhat relative to your partnered sex life, but it's also valuable in its aloneness.
Mm-hmm.
Because that can be really, really helpful. Like, I know personally my sir loves when I come to him with, like, new sex nerdy stuff I've found out. Like, you know, I can come to him and we can be in the middle of, like, sexting, and I'll be like, oh my god, I just felt my G-spot swell with fluid. Like, that's so fascinating. I literally, like, felt it grow. And he's like, oh my god, let me feel. Like, but I know, like, it can be really exciting to find out really nerdy shit about your own body and about your partner's bodies. So even just framing it as, like, a research thing can be really cool, too.
Yep, yep. I've also sometimes imagined that someone was instructing me to jerk off, which I'm sure, based on what you wrote to us, is something that you've probably experimented with or at least thought about. And that is also a cool stepping stone in a way. Even if you have to imagine that person as, like, your fave celebrity or your fave fictional character. Like, admittedly, I have jerked off to the idea of Rosa Diaz from Brooklyn Nine-Nine telling me I had to jerk off. But, like, whatever works.
I
haven't,
but I will now.
Oh, gosh, so many good memories. Fuck. Yeah, hope that helped. So here's some fun questions. Your go-to erogenous zones, the ones that rev you up the quickest every time, genitalia excluded. Oh, this is a good one. I'm so nerdy about, like, non-genital ways to experience pleasure lately. It's real fucking good.
So, like, that spot in the corner of your neck and shoulder, like, ugh. Right at the base of your neck, like,
uh-huh,
oof.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I think that's a big one for most people, to be honest, but woof. And anytime someone's standing
last weekend, I had, like, visible bite marks all over both of those last weekend, and I was like, fuck yes.
Excellent. Yes. That, or anytime as someone is standing or laying or whatever with their chest against my back. Oof. I don't know why, but just that. Or if they're just standing slightly too close behind me or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yep. I feel a lot of voice.
Very good. Yeah, I have feels also about the front of my chest, because I have sort of a Pavlovian response to that because of times that I have had enormous orgasms while someone was pressing on that spot. And the other one for me that I think we've talked about before is my external G-spot, which is, like, sort of halfway between my belly button and my clit. And I guess that would count as genital, but, like, most people don't really recognize it as such. And I also think that it responds a little bit differently than my G-spot internally does. It's just a nice place to, like, press, and, like, I really like it after orgasm, but I also really like it kind of just, like, as a comfort thing, not necessarily in a sexual situation, like, just, like, warmth and pressure. It's nice. Ooh, I'm also really into the insides of my wrists, and my newish dominant partner is into hypnosis kink, which I think we've talked about, and, like, I was discussing with him the idea of, like, a hypno scene where he would trance me to feel like a non-sexual body part felt sexual pleasure, and we were talking about how it'd be fun if those were the insides of my wrists, so he could, like, be touching me there while we were out to dinner or something, and I think that would be really fun.
Yeah, definitely.
Another one is our top three favorite erotica to masturbate to. I feel like such a nerd that I do indeed have, like, an off the top of my head answer to this. What a dork.
I do not. I primarily, like, come up with stuff in my head. Like, I have Rolodex of, like, some of my most popular fantasies. Mm. That sounds much more vulnerable.
Yeah, I am not that big on, like, traditional erotica anymore. I used to be much more into it back when I was reading, like, actual physical erotica anthologies, which is wild to think about. Like, I used to go to the bookstore when I was, like, 15 and buy these books, which I was, like, I was always like, is this illegal? Like, am I allowed to be doing this? But no, my favorite ones now are always fan fiction. I have an archive of our own account where I, like, bookmark things that really appealed to me, and I think my favorite writer on there is this person called Kasuchi, who does a lot of different fandoms, but she's written lately mainly in the Brooklyn Nine-Nine fanfic fandom, and something I really like about her work is that she really captures consent really well, like enthusiastic consent between the characters, which I think particularly is important for that fandom, because Jake Peralta, the lead character of that show, is, like, very ostensibly feminist and, like, consent focused, and so I always find her stories really hot and also, like, really relaxing to read, in the sense that, like, even though they're fictional characters, I can still tell that they're consenting, because that's important to me. She's really good. I like her a lot. Another question. this person is looking for, advice, recommendations, or links on how to best combat or eradicate seeds of toxic masculinity and misogyny, homophobia, transphobia, etc., in younger family members. It may come across as a very dumb question, they say. And if so, please accept my apologies in advance. Oh, that's cute. But I've got teen and preteen family members, and I want them to grow up to be better than either the prior generation or their older siblings and cousins. They'll make mistakes, but I'd like to help them have less to unlearn as they grow older. Oh, this is a really interesting question. Wow. I think one thing that jumps to mind for me is encouraging boys to feel their feelings. This is something I'm thinking about a lot lately, because I had a conversation with a partner recently about, like, what are some things that happen when you date women that don't happen when you date men, or vice versa? And I feel like, having dated people of lots of different genders, one of the things that comes up when I date men is I spend a lot of time being like, it's okay that you're feeling a feeling. Like, you are in a situation where it's reasonable to be feeling a feeling right now, and I affirm your feelings, and I accept them, and I will support you through them.
As if there was any doubt that I'm trans. I'm a dude.
Right.
I am one, like, of those dudes that she does that to.
There's so many dudes I've dated and known who are just like, I don't know why I'm getting so emotional about this. And I'm like, it's because it's an emotional situation. Like, it's a situation where I would have been crying several minutes earlier than they even registered they were having a feeling. So, like, I am such an emotive person that I feel like part of my, like, duty as a person who dates men is to, like, remind them, like, hey, it's cool to feel your feelings. And I think that that is, like, a starting point for a lot of important learning that a lot of men have to do. Because once you recognize you're allowed to feel your feelings, it really opens up more opportunities for, like, self-examination and, like, empathy and all those really important things that are crucial to unpacking toxic masculinity.
Yeah, I think so. I think this is a super important question. And I think the first thing I want you to recognize is that they aren't your kids, and they're already, like, teens and preteens, so there's only so much you can do for them. I don't want you to, like, get into a point where you feel responsible for these people mm-hmm. that have a lot of other influences in their life and a lot of other bigger influences in their life than you.
Yeah.
You know, they're already at school, they're already hearing things from their peers, they've already got a lot of beliefs instilled in them from their parents, and they're teenagers, and they think they know everything. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, depending on these kids, depending on how they're raised, whatever, I don't know how much positive feedback you're going to get in the moment reaching mm-hmm. out to them. But I think the most important thing you can do is just keep talking about these issues casually. Like, yeah. I don't think a teenager is going to respond great to, like, let's sit down and have a conversation about sex and toxic masculinity. Like, they're gonna check out at the beginning of that conversation, right?
Yeah.
But if you can casually incorporate things into discussions, just bringing up things you hear on the news, things y'all see on TV together, get the media that shows healthy relationships and healthy depictions of masculinity, call it out when you see weird shit, when you take them to the movies and you're like, ugh, you know, I can't believe they did XYZ, and just mm-hmm. kind of show them that there are ways to live outside of what they may or may not already know, yeah. and show them that you're a resource that they can come to and ask.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's probably going to be the easiest way to get through to them. And like I said, just accept, I don't want to sound like I'm being especially negative, but I also don't want you to take on all of this responsibility and feel like you need to save all of these kids that
mm-hmm.
you only have so much access to and you're only going to have so much influence with. Yeah. And I think at the end of the day, it's about getting them to a place where they know they can come to you if they want to do that work.
Yeah. I have this memory of my little brother He one time was telling me that a girl he knew on Facebook had posted these pictures of, like, she was really pumped up because she'd been going to the gym, and she was posting these pictures of her in a bikini and, like, basically saying that she looked great, and she did look great. And my brother was basically insinuating that, like, this was conceited of her, like, she shouldn't have been showing off her body in this way, whatever. And I remember just, like, kind of trying to be casual about it, but I was like, well, why is that a problem? Like, why does it bother you that she likes her body? What's wrong with that? And we unpacked it, and the more that we talked about it and the more he thought about it, the more he was kind of like, I guess there isn't really anything wrong with that. Like, I don't really know why I had that knee-jerk reaction to that. And that was just like a casual, easy way into a conversation about different expectations around gender. And I think that anytime you can sort of like casually question beliefs like that, it's often really helpful. It's sort of the Socratic method, I guess. It's a way of getting people to unpack their beliefs. And I think that it helps people arrive at different conclusions than they otherwise might, but without them feeling attacked or necessarily led to those conclusions. They just kind of get there on their own with a little prodding. And I found that really helpful in times that I've been like working with young people.
I find that really helpful in times when I'm working with any people.
Yeah, it's true. Okay, another one?
Yeah.
We got a question from Matt, who says, what are the three most interesting sex or sexuality studies you've encountered, and how did they affect how you approach sex? I'm such a nerd about this shit. I have a couple off the top of my head, because I'm a fucking nerd. So there's been a couple studies, actually probably more than a couple at this point, about the connections between BDSM and mental health. The latest one that I know about is done by someone whose name I'm going to absolutely butcher right now. I think her name is Dulcinea Pitagora. Apologies if I really messed that up. I'd really, really like to have her on the show, actually. We saw her speak at the AltSex NYC conference a couple years ago, and she did this study about, like, subspace and how it affects your mental state. And there's been some other work done on that about, like, the sort of mental states you get into when you do BDSM scenes and how they affect your overall psychological well-being. That stuff's really interesting. I cite that all the time when talking to people about kink and how it can improve your life if you are into it and want to do it. And also just when, like, people are often like, well, why do you like BDSM? Why do you like kink? And I'm like, well, first of all, it turns me on a whole lot, but secondly, yeah, it makes my brain feel better. The other one that I cite all the time, which is really silly, but it's the study that was done that found that women have an easier time reaching orgasm when they're wearing socks. And, like, the researchers posit that this is because when your feet are not cold, you can focus more on what you're feeling. And the reason I bring this up all the time is that I usually like to leave my socks on during sex because I get very cold feet, and usually either partners will, like, try to remove my socks, or they'll, like, lightly make fun of me for wanting to leave my socks on. I'm always like, well, there's scientific backing for why I have decided to do this. Like, you will want me to leave my socks on, my dude, let me tell you. Do you have any sex studies you like?
No.
No? I'm just the only nerd here? I don't think I am.
I don't. Honestly, I don't read sex sites.
All right, cool. Yeah, that's fine. It's a very particular type of nerd who really gets into that shit. Yeah.
So, I do read sex science. That's a lie. I just hate most of it. Because the majority of it, I find, is trying to quantify experience in a way that I don't think it can totally be quantified.
Yeah.
Like, and it seems to be, every time I read stuff, it seems to be way behind people's actual lived experiences. And yeah, I learned way more from talking to people who have experienced it. And then I go back to the studies, and they're just like, there are still studies that are like, so like the G-spot. And I'm like, people have been jerking off with it for decades. Like, I'm like, bitch, I'll show you. It's over here. Like, and it just frustrates me because they're just like, yeah, We really don't know.
You're right.
And I'm like, but we do. I promise.
Yeah. And then the problem, too, is that there's, like, nobody fucking wants to fund these studies. And so there's so many sexual phenomena that are, like, so understudied. And, like, I got really angry about this a couple years ago when this study came out that was, like, squirting is definitely pee. And when I looked at the actual science of it to research a big story I was writing about it, I found that, first of all, they only had 7 participants in the study. And the researcher was claiming that it was the biggest study that had ever been done on this topic, which was actually factually not true. My editor, who I wrote the piece for, wouldn't let me write, dude is wrong, but he was wrong. And then the other thing was when I looked at the actual, like, chemical breakdowns of all the different chemical analyses of the samples they had taken, they were, like, all over the map. Like, I don't know how this dude looked at these different samples and, like, unified them into the idea that, like, squirting is pee, because basically, like, some of it was pee for some people, and some of it was definitely not pee, and some of it was a mix of both, and, like, it was just all over the place. So it was like, where did you find, like... It was very, like, sexist and patriarchal, and it was very, like, can we just trust people with their goddamn bodies? Like, what are you doing?
Well, like, so here's the thing, too. There's no money and no prestige in sex research. People who are choosing sex research are people that are going to be, like, they know they're going to be ostracized by big parts of the scientific community and everything. Yeah. That doesn't necessarily motivate people to do this. And, like, yeah, there are a lot of great scientists who are like us are just really nerdy about it and dive into it. But even, like, choosing to specialize in sex journalism is different than sex science. Like, journalism is, like, way more welcoming to that.
Yeah. Yeah,
than the science community is. So,
although I do still get ostracized in certain ways as a sex journalist.
Oh, I'm sure.
Like, there are people who very much do not take my work seriously and do not see me as a real professional and, you know, see the confessional nature of my work as delegitimizing it. And that's a whole bunch of patriarchal, misogynistic bullshit.
Yeah, absolutely. But there's... I don't know, there's a lot that goes into deciding to be a scientist who studies specifically sexual phenomena, and I think that actually says a lot about the science we get about sexual phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
And I think studying the people that study sex would probably tell us a lot about what we think we know about sex.
Yeah, I mean, I do think there's some interesting work coming out. I'm very heartened by...
Yeah, no, absolutely. Like, I'm not... That's... definitely not a universal thing.
Yeah.
But I just think that science isn't as empirical as we like to think it is when it comes to sexuality.
Oh, totally. That is a problem. We actually, I have a buddy, Eva, who is going to school to be a sex researcher and wants to do some really fascinating work, and we should have her on the show because I think she would probably have a lot to say about how sex research works. And yeah, that's a fascinating world to me.
Yeah.
Another one?
Mm-hmm.
This listener wants to know, I would love to learn about BDSM/kink party etiquette. What should you wear? Can you bring a date? What do these events usually consist of? This is a tough one to answer because I think it really, really depends on where you are and what kind of event it is and stuff like that.
Yeah, so most events will mention if there's a dress code.
Mm-hmm.
If not, I would shoot for casually sexy and I'd wear layers so that you can undress to whatever level you're comfortable at once you get there. Because sometimes I don't know, so sometimes I'll wear something that looks good, like... jeans and a nice shirt or whatever, then I could take my shirt off if I want, or I have cute underwear on that I can go around like that if I want. But a lot of spaces, if you're going to a play event, it's going to be, depending on if it's sex heavy or kink heavy, it'll be relatively fetishy clothing. Things that make you feel hot, whatever that thing is.
Yeah, and I think also, like, if you're worried about any, like, protocol-related questions, if it's, like, a Facebook event or a FetLife event or something, you can usually, like, post on the event page or, like, message the organizer or something to ask them stuff like that. And they'll usually, in my experience, be pretty amenable. Like, somebody there will be able to answer that for you.
Yeah, and the organizer, you let them know you're a newbie. They're usually, like, really welcoming and really willing to answer all your questions. And if they're not, I would say that's an event you probably shouldn't go to, honestly.
Yeah.
Like, and I think that's probably a great sign that it's not a great party for you.
Yeah, agreed. I've also found it really helpful to go with somebody who's either been to that event before or at least been to that space before. So they can maybe, like, show you around. You don't feel quite as nervous. I get really anxious about, like, protocol when I'm going to new places. Like, where do I walk in? And, like, who do I say hi to? And, like, you know, all that stuff. So I find it really helpful to go with somebody. In most cases, you can bring a date to these events. And I would recommend it, unless you are really a person who thrives in, like, going on adventures by yourself. But, like, I am super not. And, like, I am the type of person who is so anxious that I might walk to the event and then circle the block a few times and still not be able to go in, and then maybe circle the block another couple times and maybe go in, or maybe just not go at all. So, like, I find it helpful to go with a person, because not only does that make me feel less anxious, but also, like, I have to actually go.
Yeah, I think bringing a date is super helpful. I think it's really good to also go into events like this without expectations, or planning to play with your date and, you know, maybe no one else, or, like, maybe we'll just watch. Like, I went to a new play party this weekend, and I was very much of the mentality, like, I'm going to go and find out what this party looks like so that later I can decide if I want to go to this party and play. Like, it was fully just, like, let me see what the crowd looks like. Let me figure it out. I'm probably not going to play tonight. I can come back if I want to play another time. So, like, especially that first time, be like, this is just a reconnaissance mission.
Yeah. That reminds me, too, of, sorry, of what I was saying earlier about the time-limited thing, because I find that helpful as an introverted, anxious person for events as well, because if I'm, like, I'm just going to go and I'll stay for an hour, and if I hate it after an hour, I can leave. But, like, usually if I'm there for an hour, I'll want to stay a little bit longer and check it out more. But, like, that container helps me feel much more comfortable going.
Yeah, I did the same thing. I was like, all right, I'll still stay till midnight. Whatever happens at midnight, I'll decide if I want to go. And I was, I wound up staying until, like, 1:30. But as far as etiquette, honestly, it's not as different from any other party as you'd expect, to be honest. Don't touch strangers. You know, navigate consent like you would any other sexual interaction, you know, checking in, things like that. The only difference really is that people are going to be playing in the space. And in regards to that, there are usually, a lot of play parties have systems set into place. Like, oh, if the door's open, you can look. If it's, you know, if the door's closed, you can look through the windows. If it's open, you're invited to join or whatever. Like, I've heard clubs have setups like that. So same idea. I try to avoid, like, standing and gawking at a particular scene for any length of time. You never want to get super close. Like, if they can feel you in their personal space, you're a part of their scene now, and that's icky. Don't do that. Don't, like, the biggest etiquette thing is don't assume your party etiquette changes because it's a sex party.
Yeah, like, at my local sex club, there's quite often people who will come up to me and, like, basically proposition me for sex before they even, like, talk to me about anything. And I feel about it the way I feel about anyone doing that at any kind of party, which is, like, I want to talk to you for a few minutes before we talk about maybe doing more than that. Like, I want to get to know you as a person a little bit. But, I mean, the other side of that coin is I do actually appreciate the clarity and the openness of people at sex events, which I think is not always present at non-sex events, because, like, sometimes people hit on you at a vanilla party and you're like, oh, I think this person's trying to get into my pants, but I don't know. Whereas at a sex party, sometimes people are like, hey, so I find you really attractive. Do you want to play? Which, like, if there's a rapport there already, that's nice. I enjoy the clarity of that, just as long as they fuck right off if I say no.
Yeah. And then the other thing is, like, every place is going to have a lot of specific rules, and I recommend going to a place that has, like, pretty clear guidelines for your first party. Once you get used to them, maybe then you can start exploring other ones, and then you'll already have folks you know because you're a part of the scene. But your first party, I would look for one that lists, like, guidelines and dress code and etiquette, because a lot of them will provide that information for you, and then you can feel more prepared going into that space.
Yep. As an anxious person, I like to know all the possible information that I might need to know. So, yes, same. That is helpful for me.
Like, ah, allow me to do a dissertation on this party before I arrive.
Yep. Okay, one more question. Dakota wants to know, do you have any advice for someone who wants to be non-monogamous but is currently in love with someone who isn't okay with that sort of relationship? Before I met this person, I was coming to terms with being poly, and now I feel like I've taken a step backwards, but I don't want to lose this guy either. Oh, I have been there. I have so been there.
I have also been there.
Yikes. So, I mean, I think that there's nuance to this, but I do want to, like, slot the tough love in right off the top and tell you it might not work, and you might just have to, like, suck it up and make a really difficult decision.
Non-monogamy is one of those things that, like,
yeah,
is hard to compromise on. It's like babies. You can't have half a baby. Like...
I had a partner for 3.5 years who I started to realize not too long into that relationship that non-monogamy was something I was interested in, and he was, like, the most monogamous person I've ever known in my life, and we had negotiated this compromise at one point where I was allowed to flirt with and kiss other people, because I thought, you know, what I'm really missing is that, like, flirty excitement of connecting with a new person. So I thought that that would be okay. The other problem was that he didn't want to hear about any of it, which was really hard for me because he's my best friend. I wanted to tell him everything. It felt like I was cheating if I didn't tell him about it, even though I technically wasn't. And so we attempted to compromise, but it just led to a lot of, like, confusion, because when you flirt with and kiss somebody, they tend to think that you're going to want to do more than that, and often you do want to do more than that, and you can't. And so that, and then the don't ask, don't tell thing really just led to a lot of confusion and problems, and we broke up for a lot of reasons, but that was one of the reasons. And I think so many people go through so much heartache trying to make their square-shaped partner into a circle-shaped partner, and it's just not good for either of you. I think that there are compromises you can explore, but you might get to a point where you're just like, we are of different orientations romantically and sexually, and we just can't be together. And, like, that is so hard, but, you know, it's a tough pill to swallow, but I think it's really important, because once you get to that point and you do that, you can move forward and look for people who are really going to be a better fit with you. I know it's so painful. It's really, really hard. I've been there. I'm sorry. But sometimes you just got to do it.
Yeah, I think the steps leading up to that point, I think it can be really helpful for you to kind of educate yourself on what monogamy looks like and what non-monogamy looks like and what you even want. Because mm-hmm. Just going to someone and being like, hey, I want to be open, gives them a very scary picture. But also, like, if your partner said yes tomorrow, would you know what your next step is? Would you know what you wanted to do? Would you know what you wanted that to look like? Because relationships are about compromise, but at the same time, it can be really, really helpful to know what your ideal is and what you're able to compromise on and what you're not.
Which, like, sometimes you might not know that until you try it, to be fair. Like, I used to think I was very much hierarchical poly type of person, and then meaning that, like, I wanted to have a primary partner and I wanted all my other partners to be less important by definition, and the more that I played with those dynamics, the more I realized that's not really how my brain works, that's not what I want, that doesn't feel good to me. So, like, it's good to have a starting point. However, do keep in mind it might change.
Yeah. Oh, it can absolutely change. And knowing, like, reading all those books and knowing what you think would work really well for you does not mean that that's necessarily the kind of relationship you're going to be in. Like, there are parts of some poly dynamics I'm in that are not ideal, and there are other parts that I adore, and, like, I made that conscious decision that I was able to be flexible on certain parts. But you got to kind of have a really thorough understanding of what your relationship and what your relationship to relationships can look like. And then at the same time, I think it's really helpful to if your partner is open to it, give them resources. I don't think anyone who's new to poly should have their partner being their only resource. Like, we talked about this in the last episode, actually. Mm-hmm. So I think giving them resources to kind of, because again, walking up to someone and being like, I want to be open, that can bring a whole range of different pictures to their mind. You know what I mean? Like, they could be thinking Eyes Wide Shut. They could be thinking like 70s hippies, yeah, free love, whatever. They can think you want to have four people living in your house with you that are all six of you are married to each other. Like, I don't know what, meanwhile, you're like, I want to have a threesome every, you know, 6 months. Like, those are all on the spectrum of non-monogamy. Yeah. So I think having, like, nuanced conversations about what could work and what couldn't work and really exploring all of your options mm-hmm. is the only way to find out if there is a middle ground that's comfortable for you. And if there isn't, then I think you need to recognize that, like, this is a really hard thing to compromise on.
Yeah, yeah. And I think also, like, if you are going to try to delve into it with someone who's never done it before and is feeling really uncertain about it, it's very, very important to keep in mind you're going to need to talk about feelings probably more than you've ever talked about feelings in your life.
Oh my God, so many feelings.
And that's a skill you have to develop as you get into non-monogamy. And sometimes it feels like so much. Like, you're like, I can't believe we're talking about feelings this much. But it's really, really important because you need to talk about, like, any feeling that comes up. And you might need to do a lot more reassuring than you're used to doing. Like, a lot more like, I still love you. I still value our relationship. You're still very important and special to me for all of these reasons. It's important to remember that that stuff might be obvious to you because you spent a lot of time with this person. You know why you love them. You know why you value them. But they might need to hear that. Even if they already know that stuff, they might need to hear it a lot more in order to feel secure going into whatever you're going into next. And you have to be cool with that. I always say poly is like a lot of scheduling and a lot of talking about feelings. Like, those are the two main skills I have gained.
You can also, I think, it can be helpful to spend some time thinking about what it is that you want out of non-monogamy. Not practically, mm-hmm. like, you know, two girlfriends and a cat. Like, what...
Sounds great.
What are you looking for? Like, are you missing that NRE energy? Like, you were talking mm-hmm. about those warm fuzzies and that newness. Are you missing, like, are you not getting kink in your current relationship? Are you... Like, what are the things, and it doesn't have to be a deficit of your current relationship, right? There are all kinds of different reasons that you might want to explore kink and think about, or also kink, but not monogamy. and thinking about what it is, like, for me, I really appreciate the independence that comes with non-monogamy. I can't imagine picturing myself as the half of a whole, and... feeling that tethered to another partner all the time and feeling like my sexuality and my flirtiness is kind of core to my identity, and like feeling like someone else would own that when I'm in a relationship with them just doesn't feel right. It feels restricting and it feels uncomfortable, and monogamy just never made, like, there was never a time in my life where I was like, yeah, that seems reasonable. Like, I was always like, nah, I'm not. I thought I was just not gonna have a boyfriend when I was little, and then I grew up and I was like, wait, I can have three. who knew? So I think just unpacking what draws you to it, and allowing your partner to unpack their fears about it, right? If they can come to you and say, well, I'm not interested in it, and their answer might just be, I'm just not down for that, and that's fine. But if they want to pick through some of their fears, or like, you know, I'm not down for that because I think it means I can't fulfill our relationship, or I think it means I'm lacking, or I think you'll find someone you like better than me and you're gonna leave or whatever, and you can kind of talk about, okay, why are these things scary? What can we do to mitigate how scary they are? And how can I just sit in this moment with you, with your feelings, and reassure you and also allow you to kind of experience those feelings and just hold space for those fears and recognize that they're going to come up again and again and again and again and again.
So much talking about feelings. I love it. It's great.
So much.
I love getting communication nerdy with partners. Such good shit. Anyway, thank you for all those great, great questions, folks.
I love these so much. This is, favorite type of episode.
Thank you, babes. You can always send us questions at thedildorks@gmail.com. I think we're going to try to do these more regularly because they're really fun, but that, of course, requires you to send us questions, so do that. Thank you so, so much. I have been Kate Sloan. You can find my sex blog at girlyjuice.net and the rest of my writing at katewritesaboutsex.com. And please follow me on Twitter and Instagram at girly_juice. I went on a delightful Twitter rant today because The Sun wrote a piece about something I wrote and I was like, fuck you, The Sun. And so there's lots of good ranting on my Twitter. You wanna get on there.
They were the worst.
They were the worst.
I wanted to tag them and be like, be better. But, like, I don't think they can. I think they're just like that. So they should just, maybe just stop.
Yeah, maybe all just. All of it. Just stop, yeah.
Yeah.
Let the sun go out. Who are you, friend? Where's your stuff?
I'm Bex. You can find all my writing at BexTalkSex.com. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at BexTalkSex. Together we're the Dildorks. We're at the Dildorks on Twitter and Instagram, and at thedildorks.com. You can find us by You can find us in all our other episodes by searching the Dildorks in your favorite podcast app. And while you're there, like and review us, or even just like 5 stars, something. It makes us way easier to find to other sex geeks, and also makes me smile. If you want to support us, you can head over to patreon.com/thedildorks. Tossing us a few bucks helps us keep doing what we're doing and helps us get to really rad places like the Playground Conference.
Hey, yeah, come to the Playground Conference. We are doing a live episode there, which is going to be about sex and travel. Oh, it's going to be fun. We're going to talk about trying to take the 11 through the TSA.
Woo! And that time I chased it around an airport. Yelling at people.
So, so good. You can find all the info about the Playground Conference at playgroundconf.com. That's playground, C-O-N-F.com. I have a hotel room to myself with a king-size bed, so I feel like I'm probably maybe going to have some sex at this conference, but we'll see how it goes.
I have a hotel with a king-size bed, and I have a feeling I'm going to have some ice cream at this conference alone in my big, fluffy hotel bed.
Can I come have ice cream with you, friend?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, that seems like
I'm gonna have like a fluffy hotel bed surrounded by dildos.
We should do some kind of live stream thing at Playground. I think if we.
I'm not gonna be wearing pants.
I mean, I think
I'm in a fluffy hotel bed.
Our audience is down.
They're only invited if they want to see me in my Pokemon boxers.
I do, yes. Absolutely, I do. Thank you to Protodome for the use of our theme song, I Want You in My Bedroom. You can find his music at protodome.bandcamp.com. And thank you to Amy, who did our logo for us. She is at starboots_ on Twitter. And thank you to you for listening. Until next time, folks, get out there and live your sexy, dorky life.
Bye.
Okay, let's do a countdown. Five.
Okay, five. Oh.
That's not supposed to happen. What's the protocol? Shit.
I start. I always start.
Okay.
Five.
Four.
Three.
Two.
One.
We already fucked something up. It's fine. I like showing people Wizard Bex, and my favorite thing about it is that this conversation always starts with the question, have I ever showed you Wizard Bex? And if I haven't mentioned this to them, then they're like, what the fuck? But then I get to show them Wizard Bex.
Which is excellent, really.
It's very, very good.
Can Wait. I tell you something before you start?
Yeah.
Because I was going to just do this in the middle of the episode, but I figured you'd lose it and it wouldn't work. But if I open the top drawer of this dresser that I'm in right now, it's full of cookies.
Bex!
This is what I moved into the new place. It's full of cookies and sex toys. Like, that's literally it.
That's all you need.
I'm living here for like 2 weeks. I have no other food. Weird. I have to go get more.
Very weird. I don't know what to tell you.
Anyway, I'm sorry. I just went, I want a cookie. Ooh.
You just did the sexiest thing with your lips. It was so funny.
I didn't mean to.
It was so close to my face.